Okay, we're in New York City on Monday, October 4th. We're interviewing Sandy Weill. With us, I'll let everybody introduce themselves who's on the in the room. And before I start that, Art Wilmarth and Mike Easterly are on the phone with us from Washington, D.C. With us is Sandy Weill and Brad.
I'm Brad Karp from Paul Weiss in New York.
Don Norman from the FCIC.
And Gary Cohen from the FCIC.
Mike Conway from Sandy Weill's office.
And Larry Pedowitz from Walk Till Lipton.
And Sandy Weill.
Who knows, needs no introduction. Well, thank you very much for agreeing to this for agreeing to this interview. And I know you have to leave at noon, so we'll get right away. What do you define as the financial crisis? What aspect or what happened that caused it to become a crisis rather than just a recession?
I think that several things happened to make what the result of the economy be much worse than anything that we've witnessed, and I think that a lot of it related around what happened in the housing market in the United States, and I think that the problems as it related to that were manyfold, starting with the idea that we moved away from people putting down payments onto houses to the theory that house prices were going to go up forever, and therefore everybody would be able to afford a house because it appreciated, and that's the way they would get their equity in it. So the underwriters agreed to let people buy houses without any significant down payment. A lot of people didn't have the income levels to support what might happen if prices didn't continue to rise. A lot of the documentation, I think, or what I've heard on these mortgages were not as accurate as they might have been.
Joining us is Kim Schaefer, also a colleague from the FCIC.
Hi, Sandy Weill. We had just started, and we're talking about what possibly caused the financial crisis. So I think that the American dream changed from being a dream to an entitlement for everybody, for first houses, for second houses, sometimes even for third houses. And if you compound that with... So I think that, going back, I think partly that was a problem that with the regulators allowing mortgages to be done that way, Fannie and Freddie accepting mortgages that were in that kind of form, which broadened the market substantially further. And then compounding that with the financial... companies in the financial industry increasing their leverage dramatically from what was a much lower level to things where their balance sheet was levered 30 or 40 to 1, taking their eye off the ball on these products because a lot of them were rated AAA by the rating agencies, and the risk management people at places looked for the what's going on here? I can't think of this.
I'm sorry.
Thank you.
The
rating agencies rated things, and the risk people really were looking at lower-rated instruments as risk, the leverage in LBOs as risk, but really when something was rated AAA or super senior, they felt that that was okay, and they didn't look at that, and that's something that really pervaded the thing, which let them feel too comfortable about an asset class that turned out to be somewhat toxic. When you look also at the financial industry, and you look at the leverage that they had on the balance sheet, there really was no transparency that was visible to regulators or others as to what was off the balance sheet, and the ease with which they can financial companies were able to move assets off the balance sheet, which increased the leverage substantially more than what was reported. I think all those elements contributed to the problem.
A senior administration official who has left recently to go back to school told us, I won't name him.
You don't have to.
Told us he thought that the housing bubble, the collapse of the housing crisis and the bursting of the bubble was the immediate trigger. He said he thought the financial system at the point that it had reached in 2007, 2008 was ready for some shock. And if it hadn't been the housing price declines, it might have been something else. Do you did you see a change? I mean, you've been in the financial services industry forever, and how has it changed to where it actually, where a credible academic and economist could say that?
Well, I think you happen to, this person that's nameless happens to be, I think, a very bright person who is worth listening to. So I would follow on what he said, in that if you want to look beyond the housing crisis, the development of a lot of these structured products and derivative instruments that really also related to what a company's rating was without any real mark-to-market kind of mechanism, allowed a lot of these markets to expand dramatically beyond the level of regulation. At the point in time that we're thinking about in 07, 08, the Federal Reserve, who I think is an organization that understands markets and how the markets operate much better than any other regulator, really only had a visibility of part of the market, because at that point in time, investment banks were still a big part of what was going on in these derivative markets, as well as insurance companies like AIG doing credit default swaps, and which were all based on if you had a good credit rating, you didn't have to put up any collateral. And yet, with the best of thinking about history, if one looks back and thinks about what were the blue chip stocks in the 40s, and then look at what were the blue chip stocks in the 50s, and then look at what were the blue chip stocks in the 90s or 80s, they were entirely different companies, and a lot of things that were considered to be blue chips changed over time with technology and how fast the world was changing. And therefore, you know, when you're doing derivatives that relate to long-term credit of companies, that's a very hard thing to do, and they change over time, and I think it really calls for having some kind of collateral put up by the people that use those instruments, so that it's always marked to market, and you're not going from very good to a disaster overnight. I also am not a big believer of models where you talk about something is one standard deviation or whatever, which is based on looking in the rearview mirror and looking backwards. And they always work as long as the world is the same as it was when you look backwards. When one takes into account that that is changing, all of a sudden what is one standard deviation can be 5 or 10 times because of how situations change, and the industry wasn't prepared for that.
I'm sorry. Could you all speak up? It's very difficult to hear.
Well, we're doing the best we can, Mike.
Okay. All right.
Let me ask you a philosophical question. Do you think the crisis was a failure of a system or a failure of men and women? But mostly men. Mostly men.
Are you implying that if it was mostly women, it wouldn't have happened?
I did not ask the question.
You know, I think that it was really a lot of things that entered into it, but you know, I think that markets are governed and move in a lot of ways by, you know, psychologically, as you're talking, by fear and greed. I think that human nature being human nature, people tend to forget problems and do things, or, you know, this won't be the last crisis we ever have. You know, I think they always happen. This was a very difficult one, and hopefully people have learned their lesson.
Well, do you think it was a failure of regulation? Do you think that regulation should have been different, that we had good regulations and bad regulators, or bad regulations and bad results? Or
Well, I think, you know, as I indicated before, I think that I think the Federal Reserve is a very good regulator of markets, but it's very hard to be a perfect regulator of markets when they only have about 30% of the information. Mm-hmm. And I think now, I think with the investment banks becoming banks and being regulated by the Fed, and all of the hedge funds and private equity funds saying that they would accept more regulation, and all of their activities are cleared by people that that are regulated to an extent by the Federal Reserve. You know, I think we will be able to have a better system. So I you know, I think could the regulators have done better? I think the answer is yes, but I think they were terribly handicapped by a lack of information and by the direction that people wanted to go at that point in time. From my experience, I don't know every regulator, but the biggest part of my career, I was regulated, the company I was in was regulated by the SEC, which is really much more of a policeman than an organization that's proactive, looking forward, trying to prevent things. Mm-hmm. When my career switched to my being in the banking business as well as the investment banking business, we were regulated by both the OCC and the Fed, as well as insurance regulators and the SEC. I found, as I said, the Fed to be terrific on markets, and I was on the board of the New York Fed for 5 years, and yes, I participated in a lot of those conversations. I was there at 9/11 and watched our reaction, our being the Federal Reserve, reaction to the problem, what happened with 9/11 and the markets shutting down, and how fast they worked to get them running again. And I also feel and felt that the OCC was a terrific regulator of how a company ran a financial business, so that they had, you know, their strengths were in different functions. The OCC had 40, 50 people in our office all the time, so they knew our business. I would meet with them quarterly, and lots of times when I would get nervous about risk or seeing some things happening in the market, I would ask the person that was in charge of our account, I said, make me nervous. Tell me, what should I be worried about? And I'd be able to utilize the strength of what the Treasury and OCC knew by regulating all of the bank companies, national bank companies. You got a pretty good idea of what was happening. And they were there to prevent things from happening, not just on the risk side, but they reviewed all of how a company was doing in technology and was their technology up to snuff. Went through Y2K and watching how they participated in that. So I think we have the makings of very, very good regulators that I think with some of the changes that are going to happen now, we'll be able to do a better job.
Kent, Donna, do you have anything?
Just to continue on Gary's point, with some good regulators and some good markets people, what market insights? Why were mortgage and CDO and leveraged loan positions allowed to grow to such an extent that they threatened the viability of some certain institutions?
I think they made. I alluded to that. I think before you came in or at the beginning, I think they made a big mistake in that. I'm just talking about what I think the ability that's there, and I think that the allowing the leverage to be as big as it became, allowing the ease to take things off the balance sheet so it didn't affect the leverage, which in effect really made it worse because of the things that were off the balance sheet were mirror images, a lot of stuff that was on the balance sheet. Witness the forcing of a lot of the stuff back on the balance sheet and taking big losses to put them back there, which caused a lot of institutions to have to raise additional capital.
You were relatively conservative, I would think, when you were managing Citi, and in prior parts of your career, you would try to get out of risky businesses if you possibly could. Do you think?
I got us out of the long term capital look-alike in '98 before.
And so how did? I mean, first of all, what forces do you think in Wall Street, or in the financial, not just Wall Street, but the rest, commercial banking and all the rest, the financial services industry, do you think that compensation structures created too much of an incentive for, you know, greater leverage, greater risk-taking?
I think that I'll answer that two ways. When I was at Citi, we had a compensation system where the senior people, somewhere between 20 and 50 people, were the majority of their compensation was in equity-related things, either common stock or options. And the senior people at the old Travelers, before our merger with Citi, had to keep 100% of their stock until they retired. And the only way they're able to get rid of that is to get any of the stock was to give it away to charity, where we encouraged all of our people to be philanthropic with their own money as well as with their time to try and make the world a better place. That went from 100% to 75% in '98 when we merged our companies with Citi to form Citigroup, which was still a significant amount of the company stock. So nobody was being paid to produce this quarter results or this year's results because they couldn't sell their stock, at least in our company. Having said that, I think compensation and Wall Street, parts of Wall Street have always been very, very high. There was a big difference in the compensation of what bankers got paid and what normal walking around people in the financial industry that were in the commercial banking side of the business got paid. then the problem in changing compensation is that you live in a very competitive world, and one company can't do it alone. It has to be the whole industry. and it was hard to get the industry to do that as long as the customers that used their services were willing to pay the prices that they paid for their services. Mm-hmm. But I think that's obviously in the process of changing.
Mm-hmm. Well, there's certainly more emphasis on long-term compensation. We'll see whether it makes a difference. So when you left Citi, do you think there was a marked change in the culture, in the risk management culture?
You know, what I'd rather do, I don't know what, when I left, it's, you know, I think leaving, you know, the day I said I was no longer going to be the CEO was the next day nobody talked to me anymore, so, and I don't think...
Sandy who?
Yeah, right, exactly. You know, I think if you look at the results of what happened in Wall Street, it became, well, this one's doing it, so how can I not do it? If I don't do it, the people are going to leave my place and go someplace else. So that I think that risk became less of an important function in a broad base of companies, I would guess.
Mm-hmm. Mike and Art?
Yes?
You had a question that you wanted to ask Mr. Wah?
Yeah, well, we had two questions, but the one that's appropriate now is about Salomon Brothers. And when you bought Travelers, Salomon Brothers came along, and Salomon was known, you know, as risk takers. Our question was, you know, they had been in trouble, I think, several times, or I was wondering, how did Citi integrate that group within the broader organization, and what sort of steps did you take in terms of risk management with Salomon?
Okay, Travelers bought Salomon,
right.
And that was in 1997, I think that our reasoning was that the markets were really becoming global, that the Travelers investment banking operation, which was called Smith Barney at that point in time, was by and large a domestically focused organization with not really enough of a global footprint. And we felt that our business was diversified enough, and the income that we had was large enough that we can afford the risk. So we went ahead and bought Salomon. And the year that we bought them, you know, we were very, very lucky in that it seemed to be, it was such a stable time. It happened to be within 6 months. We had the Asian financial crisis with several countries nearly going out of business. We had the problem with long-term capital going out of business, and we also had the issue with Russia going bankrupt. So in that stable period of time, you know, we really began to focus much more on the risk that we were taking, and this would go back to looking in the rear view mirror or looking out the front window. I remember when Salomon had this arbitrage or something that was a fairly big profitable part of the company, did trading and made profits on a pretty regular basis for the 4 or 5 years before we bought the company, and we're investing a lot of that money back into growing a global footprint. And in the beginning, I can't remember whether it was in the middle of 98 or the middle of, I think it was 98, I saw that we started to we lost money for 1 month in this thing, which never lost money, and I began to question it. And then when it lost money for the second month, and when it lost money for the third month, and the answers that we were getting, didn't make a heck of a lot of sense. I said, we're going to get out of this business, or we said that we're going to get out of this business, which was not really the main reason that we bought Salomon Brothers. And we liquidated those positions, which helped us not end up getting into a very big problem when what I think happened is that there were people that left Salomon Brothers that were all over Wall Street, and not just in the long-term capital, which were people that left Salomon, but four or five others. They all did the same thing. They all had the same models, and it all worked until everybody tried to get out of this tiny little door. And the door, it was like being in a movie theater that had a fire with no exits. And what had some intrinsic value went way down in price, which created problems. But we were mainly out of a lot of that at the time. And we ended up with a lot of very good people in the banking side and the trading side of the business that we didn't have before. And that was integrated with not just with Smith Barney, but also with the city group operations. So if you look at 1998, which was the year that we merged our two companies, I think our profitability was a little bit over $6 billion. When I retired in 2003 from being the CEO, our profits 5 years later would have more than tripled that. So I think that sort of says we integrated it pretty well.
You know, it's interesting what you said about what happened, where you look, lost money, get out of the business. Another major Wall Street firm had a similar experience and told the commission that, you know, we looked at what was happening on a monthly basis. We didn't understand why, but we were losing money, so we changed positions completely. And other firms did not, you know, in the run-up to the collapse of the housing market. Mm-hmm. So I guess it really is a question of senior management paying attention at some level. And other people sometimes do, mm-hmm, and sometimes don't.
I think, you know, you're supposed to learn as you go through life.
Yeah.
And I guess maybe I learned a lot from a previous experience when in 1983, early 84, I was working at American Express Company, and one of our subsidiaries was Fireman's Fund in the property casualty business, headquartered out near San Francisco. And that company started to lose money, and I was listening before I got involved to the actuaries talking about, it's really not something to worry about. It's just 1 month or 2 months. You've got to average.
Well, I had a follow-up question.
Hang on.
I was just with
Mike.
Relevant in the long-term capital management experience. And it seemed to me that, and I think, in your views on this, that in many ways the Russian crisis and the experience of long-term capital management was almost a miniature of what happened in 2007 and 8 when suddenly markets that were thought to be highly liquid but really involved a lot of fairly high-risk instruments suddenly froze up and there was no exit. And I was wondering why you think perhaps there wasn't more learning on Wall Street about that, and that, in a sense, many firms went into the fall of 2007 with positions that at least were, you could say, analogous to the kind of positions they were holding in 1998. And unfortunately, this crisis turned out to be much larger and much more devastating than the Russian one was.
Okay, let me just finish with one sentence on what I was doing before, which was saying that I happen to have the experience of watching actuaries evaluate and management follow a thing by averaging something and not giving much more weight to current months, and therefore it delayed a company reacting to what was in the process of becoming a big issue, which helped my thinking about being more, you know, 1 month, 2 month, 3 months bingo, rather than, you know, having something be proved out over a much longer time, which is more of an academic way that people look at it. When you compare, and going to your question about comparing uh, long-term capital to what happened in 2007, 2008. Personally, I don't think it's a very good comparison. There was one similarity that a lot of the underlying paper in the long-term capital situation related to Danish mortgages, which there was a very, very small market in Danish mortgages, and people, when they had to liquidate and try and get capital to pay other margin calls, they tried to get out of the Danish mortgages. There was no market, so the things went down. However, I believe, I don't know this for a fact, but the Danish mortgages were really okay, and you know, there were people that had collateral in these things, and the reason I say that is if you look, you know, we as an industry got together and raised several billion dollars to put into long-term capital so that it could have an orderly liquidation, and over the next 2 to 2.5 years, the long-term capital was liquidated, and it was liquidated in a way where we got all of our money back plus a tiny little return, which I think said that the assets were properly valued. What happened in 2007, 2008 in the housing market is housing prices had gone up by double digits for a decade or more. Prices got very, very high, and they weren't worth it. You look today, and people that were encouraged to buy those houses, which helped create the excess supply, were people that really didn't have the income levels, I think, after the fact, to be able to afford those mortgages. And so a lot of funny kind of instruments were created where you didn't, no interest down for the next 5 years, or something that was 1% for a period of time, or 0.5%, and then it floated up dramatically into the future. And the future came, and the prices didn't bail out what the people could afford to pay. And so that put a slug of stuff on the market that really didn't have the value that was forced into the market by so many people chasing so little goods.
Do you know,
it's basic
the Fed,
economics.
The Fed was aware of the bubble. There's indications that as early as 2004, 2005, people were talking about the bubble, and Bernanke was on record as saying, we think it's manageable. The subprime, people have, there are quotes from before 07, before 08, saying we see there's a bubble, it's manageable, it won't have the result it did. But going back to the former administration official who talked about the fragility of the system, what was it, do you think, about the nature of the financial system that caused what should have perhaps been a bubble? I mean, the 87 crash was a lot of money lost. It didn't destroy the economy. The dot-com...
It was very fast, though, and
recovered very quickly. That's correct. And then the dot-com destruction took away a lot of household wealth, didn't destroy the economy. But the subprime meltdown reverberated, you know, to everywhere. And I'm wondering if you can give us your view as to what was different about it.
I think you're really better off asking a psychiatrist. I remember at 9/11, my company had backup lines to every big airline in the United States. On 9/12, every airline in the United States drew down those backup lines because they knew that their business was going to really suffer and they wanted the capital. And we went and reviewed after the fact, you know, what kind of loans were we making, what were we getting paid, little tiny amounts of money to do all this. And basically, we had to honor all of those backup line commitments, which were done really with no covenants. When I read, 6 years later that we start doing things with, covenant light, I think you should ask a psychiatrist why people didn't learn their lesson.
You mentioned earlier that leverage got too high.
Mm-hmm. And it was way too high.
Things went off balance sheet, and that created more problems and perhaps hit debt. Were off balance sheet obligations and leverage two big misses that the Fed had of Citi?
Well, I don't want to. I don't know what the Fed missed or didn't miss, but from what I read in the paper, obviously there were a lot of instruments that were created. One of them had the interesting name of SIV that owned these mortgages that were off. That weren't on the balance sheet, that obviously it increased the leverage beyond the amount of leverage that was increased. And I think that happened in a lot of places.
I'm sorry, that was a poorly worded question. Let me try that a different way.
That's okay.
Do you think that the height of Citi's leverage and Citi's off balance sheet contributed to Citi needing government assistance? Mm-hmm.
I really don't want to talk about Citi because I wasn't there at that point in time, and I'd rather speak to you if I could generally. I think it's not appropriate for somebody that doesn't really know all the facts and how it really operated or what they did to say something.
Can I?
But they did end up having a big problem.
It's
a very big problem.
Been reported, which doesn't make it true. So I'll ask you. That there came a time that you called the Citi board and asked that it evaluate removing Chuck Prince. Is that true?
Citi board. The Citi board would imply to me the whole board of directors. That I never did. Did I speak to a couple of people on the board that I thought that was an issue? I did that, yes.
When was that?
It was September of October of when did he leave? 08?
November.
Yeah.
November
4th. November
08.
November 07?
07.
07?
Yes.
So it was like a month or two before that.
And why did you make that call?
Because I read in the paper that the company was changing their earnings projection every other week and saying that there were going to be more and more losses in this, and they had what appeared to be, at that point in time, a very big exposure in something that had very small returns in the best of times. And what were they doing with this?
Did you, before things really fell apart in 08, did you have a sense that things were going to be turn out to be the disaster that they became? Or did you have any foreshadowing?
I'd be much richer.
I didn't ask you if you did anything about it. I was just asking.
Well, if I had a sense, I would have.
In your view, was allowing Lehman to fail a big mistake?
I think at the time that we being America, allowed Lehman to fail, in my mind, I said that, we're doing this to show the man in the street that everybody in Wall Street is just not going to be bailed out. And this looks like this could happen without it really taking down the system. From what I read at the specific time it was being done, I understood why it was being done, and I was not waving a flag saying this is a big mistake. If one looks at it after the fact, I think you have to say it was a very big mistake to allow it to happen.
Thank you. Just so we have your articulated views.
I think that the more important thing of what I thought was before it happened, I thought I understood why they were doing it. I thought it was okay. Everybody can be a second guesser after the fact, and obviously, when you see what did happen, it was not a very good result because it reverberated like faster than anybody imagined.
Backing up, then, do you think a lot of people have said, if you save Bear, you'd have to save Lehman. Maybe you didn't have to save Bear. I mean, do you have a view on that?
I think that the industry is so interconnected. I don't know what you could not have to save. You know, I feel pretty good that the taxpayers are going to come out positive on the money that they put in to save the system that they put into the banks. And the money that they're going to end up losing is going to really come from what they put into other industries that were really not part of the original thrust of what the so-called TARP was. Mm-hmm.
Do you, in retrospect, and I think you've been on record about this already, do you think that this is your child?
Since what?
I was about to make an aside about it. I'm asking about your child.
Right.
Do you think that the consolidation, that the repeal of Glass-Steagall, which you know you did your deal before that, mm-hmm. do you think that was a good thing? Do you think that the whole concept of too big to fail? I mean, it's a real concept. It's what the government was and continues to be concerned about. I mean, is there any way around that, or you can't unwind the clock? But I'm just wondering what your view is of the whole consolidation in the industry, where now we've got just a few firms, all of which are at this point huge.
God, I'm just trying to think of how many questions you're asking.
That's fair. I do them one at a time.
They're divisible. Yeah. So let me first start with Glass-Steagall. I think the removing of Glass-Steagall was an archaic thing that didn't really have much teeth anymore. And what Glass-Steagall going really removed, it had nothing to do with the connectivity of banking and investment banking. That had already gone by the wayside by practice and by what the Federal Reserve allowed the banks to do. J.P. Morgan was an investment bank as much as any other investment bank was when Glass-Steagall was still there. So was Bankers Trust. So was a heck of a lot of others. The only thing that we got from Glass-Steagall was Travelers was an insurance underwriter. And insurance underwriting, not insurance sales, because that also had gone, and the banks marketed insurance products, but they couldn't underwrite. So that's the only thing that Glass-Steagall removed, or the major thing. And that really didn't have anything to do with what the problems were here. If Citigroup had kept the Travelers Property Casualty Company, it would have sort of proved that a diversified financial services company is a relatively good thing, because Travelers Property Casualty Company did well through the whole financial crisis, and the stock is up making new highs all the time, and that would have helped cushion some of the other problems. What didn't work from the point of view of putting the companies together was when we tried to market personal lines insurance, homeowner insurance, to the customers of the bank. What happened was that the good risks all were happy with their insurance companies, and the bad risks took on the opportunity of giving us more business, which didn't turn out to be a very good thing from the point of view of synergy from that. So I don't think I think Glass-Steagall had nothing to do with the financial crisis. As far as a company too big to fail, let me just give you a generalization that I really feel very strong about, that since the fall of the Berlin Wall, countries all around the world have been copying the American model of free enterprise, free trade, capital markets, public securities, and that's helped a lot of the emerging markets grow. Who would have ever thought that the two biggest communist factors in the world, China and Russia, would all of a sudden become capitalists and have capital markets and have the ability to raise money? And if you look at the last decade or 10 or 12 years, we've seen, because of this, maybe at least a billion people in the world come out of abject poverty and move up into the middle class, where they're having two meals a day rather than one, which has been one of the problems in having food shortages from time to time. If we want this world to live, there's another 2 billion people that have to see that there's an opportunity for them in this current system of ours, which, you know, the United States was the creator of, and which is really working on a full-fledged basis. I would hate to think of what our crisis would have been like had it the Treasury and Fed and everybody in the government not done what they did to act as fast as they did, because they saw what happened in the 30s, and Bernanke was a student of the Depression. So he was strongly in favor of doing anything different than what we did that kept the Depression going for a decade. And the fact that a lot of these emerging market companies are doing phenomenally well, which is creating a balance to the United States. The United States is no longer the only economic engine in the world. You know, China doing as well as they have has been a great boon to all of Asia, within these Asian economies that are selling their products. You look at what's happened in Brazil. Turkey, their GDP was up 10.2% in the last quarter, but they're not good enough to be part of the European Union. We got to get this world of ours to, and I'm going to get into religion, but you don't want that. But you need
five financial institutions to dominate, you know, more than 50% of the market to do that?
Thank you. I think what the United States needs and what we deserve is we should have several financial institutions that are leaders in what's happening in the financial industry around the world. I think it would be a terrible shame if we end up breaking up our financial industry, so we're also ran, and that the leadership of what's happening is going to go to other places that learn how to do it from us, whether that's in China or Europe or someplace else. So, yes, I think that we need strong financial companies that can be leaders in the world, and I think that they're not too big. That something is not too big to fail. They're not too big to manage. Things can be managed right. We should have the regulations that help force that, which I think we're going to with a lower leverage, which was one of the major problems in this thing. I'd like to see it expanded to having mark-to-market on most derivatives so that there's collateral up there, so that we don't have big catastrophes that develop from it out of nowhere. That's basically what I feel.
Yeah, Arthur Levitt, on his interview with us on Friday, before you had dinner, made a big point about mark-to-market accounting and how important that was. Mm-hmm. So, he agrees with you on that. Although he said he would disagree with you on a lot of things, I'm not sure what.
I think he would disagree a lot less after Friday night.
One of the questions I was going to
show you what I got. And he, you know, I'm not very technological, but I have a Bloomberg machine over there, and he sent me some messages on the Bloomberg, and I don't have the capability to go back with him on that kind of thing, and he kept on interrupting my flow of market information.
You said earlier, and Jamie Dimon at the first hearing that we had back in January, some people thought he was being a little glib. He said, well, you know, financial crises are something that you have every 5 or 10 years. This was, he was explaining to his daughter what a crisis was. And you said something earlier.
A crisis is when it happens to you.
Yeah. Isn't that the depression is when you're out of work, and a recession is when your neighbor is out of work?
Yeah.
He said it happens every 5 or 10 years. Clearly, this one doesn't happen every 5 or 10 years. But do you think, and you said earlier, you think these are inevitable. Do you really think that? And is that cause for deep pessimism? Or is there something that either through regulation or through, I don't know how you enforce people to be better managers. I mean, not everybody is a Sandy Weill. There are some people who aren't. And yet, you find them at the top of major institutions from time to time. Is it a regulatory fix if indeed these kind of crises are inevitable? How do you think you get there?
You know, again, I think you know, inevitability comes to human psychology. You know, I'm glad we're doing this in the morning. My philosophy as a person is I get up every morning optimistic. I don't always go to bed optimistic, but the next morning I'm optimistic again. And, you know, I wish I was 40 years younger. I think the outlook for this world of ours is terrific. I think that it's exciting for young people like Mike and you all. And I think there's lots of opportunities that are going to happen as we hopefully can bridge these cultural divides and understand that it doesn't matter, you know, what name you put on God up there if you happen to believe in God. We've been fighting for thousands of years about what you call that person. But you read these different books, they're all the same, and hopefully we begin to, you know, we've had enough. Those are the really bad problems rather than these financial problems, and hopefully we've done a lot to learn about that and make it better. I think I think you got to run the world like it's okay to make a mistake, because if everybody is going to be so panicked about ever making a mistake, we're never going to make the kinds of decisions that are required to really move ahead and move and grow and be a leader like our country has been a leader. We shouldn't make the mistakes of the amount that the last one, which was a very, very big mistake, and we shouldn't, and hopefully we get rid of people that make the mistakes too often, but you don't want to stop people, you know, being a risk taker and being an entrepreneur. That's what built this country.
All right. For Mike?
We have one more question. This involves the acquisition of Associates First Capital, and I believe there's...
Why do you pick all the good ones?
He's unstoppable.
The question we asked is that this, as we understand it, significantly increased Citigroup's subprime footprint. It greatly increased Citi Financial's exposure to various types of subprime or you know, more aggressive loans. Looking back, do you think that might be an acquisition that maybe didn't work out as well as you had hoped? And if so, why do you think it might not have worked out as well?
Mm-hmm. First of all, let me, if I may, you know, your question is loaded, so let me just answer that it was not, it didn't work out well at all, but not for the reasons that you say. If one looks back over a 30-year period of time, the consumer finance industry had a much better record dealing with people that were below investment grade accounts in little cities all over America than any big money center bank did through crises, and that most of the regional banks did through crises. If you go back to the crisis that happened around in the middle of the 80s, when all the SNL crisis, where all the savings and loans went bankrupt in the state of Texas, and a lot of the banks, and the biggest bank in Texas got sold to Chemical Bank, which got merged and merged and merged, and is now part of Jamie's empire. Our company, Commercial Credit, had like 100 offices in Texas, and we never made less than 100 basis points profit on our assets during that period of time. Why was that the case? Because we knew our customers. We underwrote what we did in the local offices. We collected the money. We were their neighbors. We had worked with some of the families for generations of people in the family. It was a very, very good business. And people, you know, normal working people, people that work in mines and whatever, they're entitled to borrow money and try and have a better quality of life too, as long as it's done in an appropriate way. So I just want to say that there was a subprime market, a consumer finance business, before the middle of the year 2000, and it became a very different business with what happened in the housing bubble, done by very different people. Having said that, I think that we missed two things on associates. We felt that Associates, which had been part of the Ford Motor Company and was spun out a few years before we bought it, it looked to us as people in that business as being maybe the best run company in the business. That turned out not to be accurate after the fact. That some of the investigations that were going on as to into some of their lending practices turned out to be much more serious than what we thought they would be listening to management and what we knew from knowing the business from the outsides. So we made a mistake in how they ran the business, number one. But the biggest problem in that not being a big deal, a good deal, was that a good part of their income came from a consumer lending business they had that they had in Japan. Which seemed to us to be a very good way of diversifying our revenues beyond the United States. And the Japanese government made several changes in how that business could operate after we bought the company, and GE was in this business, and a lot of Japanese companies, where they cut the amount that one could charge on loans several different times, and finally to a point where what we were able to charge in interest was a level that was lower than the amount that we were, risking in lending that money to people. And the industry has basically collapsed. Everybody has lost all their money, so that really what we thought was 70% of the value of the company turned out to be worth zero. And you just saw last week, I think, a company called Takefuji, which was also one of the big Japanese consumer lenders, went bankrupt. But first the Japanese targeted the foreign lenders that had a non-diversified business, and everybody that was there ended up not having the business model, became no model with how the regulation was changed, and that is the major reason why the associates turned out not to be not only a good thing, it was bad. We could have fixed the U.S. business, but this thing could sank it.
If I can ask a less loaded question, I'm wondering about the strategic motivation for the purchase, and I ask that because there are a lot of the larger banks that were buying subprime mortgage originators from, say, 1998 to 2002. So if you could just talk about
Citi's
motivation.
Okay. Yeah, that was... The consumer, I'd rather call it a consumer finance business. But it was, you know, obviously it was subprime, and we were dealing with people that didn't feel comfortable going into a big bank and being intimidated by people, and we had a much better relationship with them. This happened to be an industry that was very fragmented. There were tons of mom-and-pop operations, and the industry had been consolidating really since the mid-80s. And one of the reasons why we decided to buy through taking the company public, Commercial Credit, out of Control Data is that we felt that we could bring in the management that could run it. We could bring in the capital. So it went from being a single B-rated company to triple B when we took over the management of it and had the capital to grow it. And it was an industry that was ripe for consolidation. And I think and I think all financial businesses as you think about the speed with which things want to be done, with the information that you have to underwrite different things, the amount of money that had to be and continues to need to be invested in technology to end up being the low-cost producer of a quality product forces consolidation so that you can compete and compete effectively.
Okay, I'm most interested in the timing of it because a lot of those considerations, could be at any given time, but there seems to be a concentration in the activity of banks going into the consumer finance.
Well, we started in the consumer finance.
Do you have a sense of why that was?
I don't think it's a good duplex.
What?
I don't think it's a good duplex. I don't think you can hear
you. We started in the consumer finance business. Our first company in what was a new career for a lot of us that left American Express, Jamie and myself and some others, was in the consumer finance business. That was the business that we're in. So we weren't going into it. We bought banks later on. Let me say that the
what Commercial Credit was.
It's a consumer finance. That's a subprime lender.
I understand. Maybe you could just give the origins of the Citigroup business, how it grew.
Let me just, I'm going to try and answer your question two ways, and I'll give you the evolution to Citigroup happening second. But first, let me say that the reason we bought Associates when we did is that Associates was spun out of the Ford Motor Car Company in a tax-free exchange. When that happens, a company cannot do any merger or a sale of itself for a period, I believe, of 2 years. That 2 years had expired, and the company thought that it wanted to do something. So that our timing related to the timing of when this was available because of the regulatory stuff of what they had done in the past. Second, let me tell you the background of Citigroup. It started with Commercial Credit going public in November of 1986. That business was subprime lending. And we bought a few other companies in that business to grow our subprime lending business. In the year 1988, we bought a company called Primerica, which owned several insurance companies and Smith Barney, and we were able to buy that because in the crash of 87, Smith Barney lost $100 million in one day in an arbitrage position in United Airlines that Jerry Tsai could not not show that, and it caused his stock to collapse, and we bought that company, which diversified what was called Commercial Credit then, and we changed that name to Primerica, the company that we bought, because now we're in not just the subprime lending, but we're in insurance and we're in investment banking. In the year 1992, we bought 28% of Travelers. After Hurricane Andrew and after some very bad investments where they needed a financial infusion. And the following year, we bought my old brokerage company, Shearson, back from American Express, which then had new management, and we merged that in with Smith Barney, kept the name Smith Barney, and we now had one of the biggest brokerage companies in the country and the world. And we ended up buying the other 72% of the Travelers Insurance Company that we didn't have, which put us into a big property casualty company, a life insurance company, and a healthcare company, which when we found out that our healthcare company, the chief medical officer was a dentist, we realized that maybe we really didn't know this business and we should figure a way to get out. Which we ended up merging with MetLife, and we still didn't know the business, and we merged, we sold that out to United Healthcare, and so that's how maybe some of you have their health insurance business. And in 1998, and through the decade of the 90s, Travelers was one of the fastest growing companies in the United States, as was Citi after it went through the problems of in the mid-80s of the LDC crisis and in the early 90s of the real estate problem. And I spoke with John Reed about why I thought our companies could make a good mix, and we announced a merger in maybe April or something like that of 1998, and that deal closed in November of 98 or October, the end of October of 98, and and we agreed on the name of Citigroup, where we kept the city from them and we kept the group from Travelers, and we kept the umbrella, and that's how we got to where we are.
Now, Mike, you may have had a question in there, Mike. I don't know if you did. Are you okay?
The question was about the timing, but he answered that.
I did with
that.
And then some. Yeah.
Thank you.
Mr. Reed had told us, I think you were on that interview. He said that I'm outing Brad. he thought that the in the 80s, I guess, early 80s, mid 80s, the availability of quick money from Drexel, for example, made senior management at many firms, including financial firms, very, very determined to make sure their quarterly results were good because of some fear of somebody getting enough money to take them over. Did you, not necessarily with your firms, your companies, but did you see that as an impetus for excessive or for the increase in risk-taking?
What Drexel did?
Drexel made it available so that if your company had a couple of bad quarters, theoretically somebody could try to do a hostile or even a friendly takeover because the money would seem to be available. Mm-hmm. And Mr. Reed said that he thought that that changed the culture of management so that it may have enhanced or maybe encourage people to try to grow quicker, to try to take more risks in order to keep the numbers up. I don't know whether you have a view of that.
Well, he and I don't agree on a lot of things, but I'm not going to go into
I've heard.
he says a lot of things.
Some people believe that the crisis was really a bank run on non-banks, on the unregulated banking community. The you know, the commercial paper market, the repo market, all freezing up. You know, the classic Jimmy Stewart, you can't have your money, it's in Sam's house, except that it was in an unregulated part of the banking industry.
You just came on a very good point. That was one of the, I've forgotten, that was one of the real disasters that happened from the Lehman, letting Lehman fail. And after the fact, it turned out that one of the big money market funds had some Lehman bonds that caused it to break the dollar, which got everybody very nervous, which helped freeze the commercial paper market, where people were just relying on ratings to access capital. GE being a big example of that. They were the biggest commercial paper borrower, I think, in the country.
Yeah, I mean, that's there are those who think that that was the nugget of the crisis, was that freezing up, which then rippled.
I mean, you know, when financial businesses are based on people having confidence in balance sheets and the numbers and being able to access the market for capital all the time. And when people, for one reason or another, like you know, the Japanese are you know, have an enormous savings pool. Maybe it's something like $13 trillion, but a good part of that is under the mattress because they don't have the confidence in some of the systems. And we've seen what the result of that has been over the last 15 years. You know, I think that that freeze had a terrible effect. You know, as did what happened later for some other reasons in the municipal market and all these auction things that were auctioned every week, and then all of a sudden an institution that thought they were paying 2 or 3%, you know, to roll the thing over had to pay double digits because there was no market.
Kim, Donna?
As a major, maybe you weren't at Citi in 2008, but as certainly a major shareholder, did you have a view on Citi's failed bid for Wachovia?
Yeah.
You share that?
Oh, my God. you know, they shouldn't have lost it. I mean, I guess, you know, I would have to say that, you know, I remember when they were buying it, I felt really good because it really got people feeling better in the company again and feeling better about the future. And then when it turned out that they lost it to Wells Fargo, that sort of really hurt the morale of the company badly. And, you know, how could we you know, Citi gave them the money to stay in business and open that Monday morning. Wachovia, I don't think, could have opened that Monday morning had Citi not been there. And how, and I was not there, so I don't know, but I find it very hard to understand. How do you do that without having a contract?
Well, some senior regulators have gone on record saying that it wasn't a great idea to put one bank in trouble together with another bank in trouble.
I think that's after the fact. You know, I don't think when Citi was buying that, I don't know, when was the Wachovia deal?
Late September, early October 2008. City stock was around 20
something,
October 3rd.
Yeah. So it wasn't 3.
No, that was later.
Right, that was later. I mean, the significance of the trouble and how much it really was, you know, much later. But if you're going to save something, have a contract, negotiate first.
Do you do a lot of reading on the financial crisis? And
yeah, I've stopped.
Have you? Well, there's certainly, it's almost like the Civil War in the number of books that have been generated.
It is.
Who do you think has gotten it right?
Well, which book did I like the best?
No, I didn't ask you that. Although I'll ask you what you thought of Sorkin's book. Seems to be the poster child. But
Sorkin's book was really interesting, especially, and you know, I hardly know him, although we graduated from the same school. But I think, and I've never said this to him, but he must have done unbelievable homework to get, in every meeting, get somebody of a group of four or five to talk. And then how to use that, going around to the next one, got one more to talk, and then the rest of them caved in to protect their reputation or how they're going to be thought in posterity, because you felt like you're in the room. I mean, it was real.
Yeah, it was a good piece
really,
of reporting.
Really good.
Yeah, yeah.
And so I read that first, and then I read half of
Michael Lewis's
book, and I decided, you know, it's enough already. And
those are more movie scripts almost. Mm-hmm. I was just wondering if you thought on the theoretical side,
theoretical side. I read. It's hard to read these books. I mean, they're, you know.
After you, but the one reading written, 10 of them is
the one written by that lady at
Amity Schlales.
Yeah, Amity Schlales.
Oh, I don't know that one.
Schlales. Yeah, uh-huh. She is historian, really, right?
Yeah, Council on Foreign Relations.
Yeah, she works with the Council on Foreign Relations. She wrote a terrific book that goes in, that really is a book about the Depression.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and, so I thought it was important for me to get to understand something about the Depression so I could have some kind of feeling about what may be unfolding here and you know, and think about what might be a bad idea and a good idea, and that got me to really appreciate what Bernanke knows. And I think that he has been incredible for a person with a 100% like academic background to be able to have the guts to be the kind of decision maker that he turned out to be in very difficult times and lead that. I think we were very lucky that he was there.
He certainly made decisions, and he's to be credited for that.
I mean, how many academics do you know that make decisions like that?
Very few.
Yeah, very few. Yeah. They'd still be on the one hand, on the other hand.
Is there anything that we should have asked you that we didn't?
My blood pressure. maybe what am I doing now?
Okay.
Basically I spend the great percentage of my time on philanthropy. I've been involved in that for 30 years, which allowed me to do something that people didn't think I'd ever do, and that is leave what they considered my day job that I would never leave. But I left and went and spent all my time. I'm chairman. Next year I've been chairman of Carnegie Hall for 20 years. We planned for these problems, and Carnegie Hall was profitable in every year through this period.
Including 08?
Including 08.
Mm-hmm.
And our endowment is basically even for 07, 08, 09 through 08, 09 and through the 3 years ending August of 2010. So we can tell people, when you're giving us your money for this thing that's we're gonna do in 5 years or whatever, you can feel comfortable that it's gonna be there to do the things that you wanted to do. I've also been chairman of Weill Cornell Medical College, which has some of the best doctors in this whole area. It's a big business, about $1.2 billion. And to be in something where a whole bunch of doctors can agree that they gotta cut back on some of the hobbies and get our expenses down to a point so that we can run this business profitable through this period, which they also did, I think makes me feel very good. Both of our both of our companies raised, Carnegie Hall got a credit rating for the first time they ever applied for it. This past year got an A-plus rating from Standard & Poor's and Moody's, and we did a $110 million bond deal to build, we're revamping the two buildings around Carnegie Hall to expand dramatically what we do in education and rehearsal space and whatever. Got all the tenants out without any major lawsuits or problems, all hopefully happy. Our medical college raised $240 million. We're building a big research project. We announced in 07 a $1.3 billion capital campaign. And in the first two and a half years of that program, we raised over $1 billion in this environment.
That's remarkable. Yeah.
And our education programs are growing. And I've been chairman of the National Academy Foundation since I formed it in 1980. So,
what's your hospital in the Middle East?
A medical school in 2000 signed an agreement to build a medical school in the Middle East and give a Cornell degree, which is it was the first then and the only one still that gives a U.S. MD degree outside the United States. And have you ever guessed, would that be in an Arab country?
Where is it?
It's in Doha, Qatar. And we opened in 2001. We've been through 9/11, the Iraqi war, the American troops moving from Saudi Arabia into Qatar to have their home base there. And because we had the guts to be the first mover, and we had a lot of people saying we shouldn't go there until there's peace between the Palestinians and the Israelis. Some of us felt the best way to have peace between the Palestinians and the Israelis is to do something and bridge those divides. Our students there, their academic performance is every bit as good as our school here in New York, which has been around for 120 years. Because we had the guts to do that, 2 years later, Gates, who's now Secretary of Defense, and he asked me, I think he would tell you this, got Texas A&M to build an engineering school there, and Carnegie Mellon built a school of information technology in Georgetown, and there's going to be a church there, built a school of foreign relations, and Northwestern is the most recent school, U.S. school, building a campus there for a journalism school, a journalism school.
It's very impressive. I didn't know that. Didn't know anything about that.
We also have working on a medical school in Tanzania. But doctors there, it's a different level. But we're, most of the average life expectancy of people is 42 years, mainly because of early childhood diseases and births, where mothers and the children really have problems, and they it's basically what you need is education and get them that the doctor is a better thing than maybe the old medicine man.
Mm-hmm. Well, I thank you. Thank you very much. This has been very helpful. Art and Mike?
I'm done.
Okay.
Nothing more from us. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
It's
thanks, guys.
Been helpful.
Thank you, guys. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Good. And you can make your plan.
I sure will.
Yeah.
That's great. Thank you.
So we're, are we off?